First Annual Research Symposium of the Late Effects of Poliomyelitis, May 25th to 27th, 1984, held at the Roosevelt Warm Springs Institute for Rehabilitation, Warm Springs, Georgia. Tape K201-9, Respiratory Problems in Post-Polios, presenter D. Armin Fisher. Bracing and Orthopedic Concepts in Post-Polio, presenter Jacqueline Perry.
The second half of this afternoon's program is Dr. D. Armin Fisher, Associate Professor of Medicine, USC School of Medicine in Downey, California.
Thank you. I'll be talking about some of the same epidemiology that we've discussed in part. Maybe we can compare a few things, but they seem to show principally the same things. We had our last polio epidemics in the late in the 40s and 50s, and after the introduction of the Salk vaccine, there was a dramatic drop. Just to give numbers, in 1952, well before Salk, they had over 37 per 100,000 population. By 55, it had dropped to 17 and to 9 in 56. And then if you look at the peak periods for the same time, that is August to September, in 1955, the number was between 2,100 and 2,500. In 56, it was down to 900, and 57 to 400. The effect of the vaccine was dramatic. It's kind of interesting to read some of the bulletins that came out from the foundation in those periods in 54, when they just were using the trials in this part of the country. And there was a lot of concern about the Salk vaccines and people injecting and limiting, causing the polio when it would have an injection in the right arm. They're afraid they'd get more polio in the right arm. There's a lot of discussion about the use of it and whether it was safe. And then it was just dramatic to see the drop. And nobody in the general going through a residency program in medicine and physical therapy, there are very few that ever see a polio patient. And one of the reasons is that the polio folks, they don't always like to be called patients, like to be around hospitals like this, that live in the vicinity or come down to it, or Rancho Los Amigos in New York, in your hospital. So people are probably not going to see much more. We'll see a lot of them in our local areas. There are probably about 200 or so living right around Downey, in Rancho Los Amigos, and they've made their home there. The whole period of development of taking care of respirator patients was a very valuable period for the development of pulmonary physiology. It was a great stimulus, and people learned about doing testing and learned about how the lungs work and breathing patterns, which nobody pays any attention to anymore, but they still have a lot of importance in knowing if you get some other kind of paralysis, how this individual is going to best breathe. Is he going to be able to breathe lying down? Is he going to have to sit up to breathe? Features of this sort. So a lot of pulmonary physiology, including the measurement of carbon dioxide to determine why some patients who had pretty good vital capacities couldn't get out of the tanks. Because when they got out of the tanks, they couldn't ventilate to a CO2 of 25. It just took too much minute ventilation for them. And it was discovered during these periods how to measure carbon dioxide and find out that they were overventilated in the tank. It was very common to have patients overventilated, and it was sort of a hit and miss to sort of determine why that was or how it was. And the irregular breathing with the medullary centers. And let's see some of these slides that I have, the lantern slides. These also go back. That film was 1958. This goes back to John F. Elton Company at the Ranch Los Amigos during the two-year period in 52-54, I believe, with the acute respirator patients. Rancho at that time was a respirator center, so all the people we got down there for the most part at that time were people on respirators that they couldn't keep in the wards of the Los Angeles County Hospital. And it's interesting to see that 73% of them who were respirator patients did come off respirators. Most of the people I'll be reviewing and talking about come from that group. Residuals, there were, of course, 14% who died and in this period. I was just mentioning that in 1960, a report came out in regards to survival of a group of high quadriplegic people with polio in that period who survived at much higher levels than they ever did in the 50s, because by that time it was sort of routine in an acute respiratory failure to stick a tube in. And so intubation got some people to the hospital that wouldn't have made it back in the 50s. So in some respects, depends on your point of view, they would recover. Some of them are very high quads and have problems with swallowing. The next slide shows the pattern of deaths in those 70 that died. And you notice that the highest percentage, or highest number of them by far, died in the first week. And then after the first month, there were sporadic deaths throughout the following year and a half. These were people who aspirated pretty regularly. Atelectasis was very common. These were things that were being seen a lot that they hadn't really thought much about before. And, development of coughlators, the development of manual coughing and so on came from this, and the recognition that pulmonary aspiration of gastric contents was very common is something that came out of the polio period pretty much. The next slide, I was going to say, these are also back from John Affeldt's 50s. I couldn't get 35 millimeters made, but I understand that some of us believe in the old equipment and we keep it around just in case. These are the time pattern of those that became free, and as you see, most of them within the first 9 months after onset had become respirator free, and then a few more tapered out till 24 months. The next slide shows a case. These are three standard case reports. This is a 32-year-old male, and this is on a percentage of vital capacity. We'll just say maybe he was normally 4 liters, and he was at 2 liters when he came in and dropped down to 400 cc's, which is about where you can't keep your minute ventilation going for very long. And then within 6 weeks it was recovering, and his tracheostomy was removed, and he continued to show improvement. The next patient shows an individual who admitted to the hospital, dropped down again to about 10%, which might have been 400 or 500 cc's. And then gradually over the next few weeks came up, but this time this individual is going to be stuck with about a 40%. Maybe he'll improve a little more after that. That's 70 days, but a lot of these people got off respirators, and this is what I'm going to be talking about mostly. A lot of these people got off respirators, and yet later on, under various stresses of one kind or another, required more respirators. The next patient, I think it's the last of the patient group, came down to the fifth day and was unable to perform a vital capacity maneuver. And After 4 months, 8 months was still running only about 20% of vital capacity, which you might say was maybe a leader. Now these people get along pretty well. Many times it's only at night. This has to do with the breathing pattern again. If they've got abdominals, they might have been hit pretty high in the bulbar area and down through the cervical, and maybe down through some of the thoracics, but left enough abdominals that they could become abdominal breathers during the day, or they'd use mouth positive with a mouth stick, or they use glossopharyngeal breathing, which I'll show one slide on, and just need to use the rocking bed or the cuirass at night. Let's look at the next slide. This shows a group. I don't have the identification of group 1, 2, 3, and 4, but you can see they go from the most severely involved to least severely involved. And what happens is that, see, the vital capacities go down to the black, and so the vital capacities are smaller. And I think probably group 1, who has a vital, obviously a small vital capacity, may be people that are still respirator dependent, but has a high residual volume. And then they get more toward normal in the next groups. And the next slide shows compliance, which some of us were talking about a little bit ago. The normal curve is the dark line, that's the round curve. And the other dark curves that are flatter, showing volume change per pressure being very small, meaning low compliance. The dotted line is a patient who's a non-polio that I know nothing about, but he's obviously better than the polios. They all have stiff chests, you might say. And have we got another slide there? Okay. This shows some, if nobody's ever, if any of you haven't seen glossopharyngeal breathing, some of you have, and I know most physicians that aren't seeing polios frequently just don't see people do glossopharyngeal breathing and can't understand that they really can get significant volumes. And this is a 2-liter one up here on top. We measure vital capacity in the clinic and GPB vital capacity when they come through regularly. And practically always they can double their vital capacity. But you can see people with a liter that'll go up to 3 liters and get the additional push. And if they need it, they can learn to do it. And they can stay off a respirator all day, even though they might have a vital capacity of 500 or something, by using glossopharyngeal breathing. Actually, Clarence Dale discovered this in 51. There was a patient that should have remained in the tank, but he was sitting outside doing this strange thing with his throat, and so Clarence observed him and said, "Hey, you can't be out here." So he started investigating it and discovered that that he was actually pushing air through the use of the tongue and the pharynx into the chest, and so then they started teaching patients how to do this. Of course, you had to get the therapist to learn how to do it. And it's a little hard to do unless you're motivated. We don't see very many spinal cord injury patients who require supplementation with a respirator learning it. We got a few, but I've often wondered if the reason for that is because they can't really be off respirators much. Most of them that require respirators require them full time. And it's a little hard for that to work. Okay, another one. No, we'll try the other slides in a minute here. I'm going to present a 114 patients in this group that we're looking at who've been actively followed at Rancho Las Migas Hospital, and. I'm also going to present 32 patients that were seen by me in the last 4 years who hadn't been previously followed. They were stimulated to come because of the heightened awareness that occurred with the Back to Braces television show in 1980, I believe, that was originated out of this institution. And when the scare about post polio syndrome and like developing ALS, and that frightened a few people to come in. So this group I will talk about. Can we have the first slide there and see what I've got? Of this group, as you can see, 22 of the group that I'm following, and I'm the respiratory service there at the Rancho, and this doesn't include all of the Rancho post polio patients, but these are the groups that we follow regularly. 22 were full-time respirators, and 70 use nighttime respirators, and then usually mouth positive or glossopharyngeal breathing or something of that nature during the day, because they could get along most of the time during the day. Then we had just mouth positive during the day who were apparently able to work out all right at night. And these people probably had effective diaphragm motion and didn't have much trouble. And we're 16 that were totally off the respirators at this point. The next slide, I think I've got it here, indicates tracheostomies and late tracheostomies. Only 35% of this original, this group that we're doing, maintained. Most of them had trachs at the time of their initial illness, and then it was closed. And then the late ones were 52. And they averaged around 18 years, from 2 years to 57 years after the onset of their polio. The indications, we had 13 out of 36 that underwent spinal fusions. I think they all had tracheostomies at the time of spinal fusion. Because of the casting problems and a few other things where it's difficult to control the respiratory system. And the idea was when they could get off and got that taken care of, they'd lose their trachs, which most of them did, but 13 never did get off the trach. The other indications are there, atelectasis, kyphoscoliosis. We had a couple of traumas. One, which is a common trauma in polio, is flail upper extremities, which is they fall occasionally, and when you fall, you hit your head. And this was a subdural hematoma. And another one had a pneumothorax, not trauma so much as an acute illness, and complicated by that, plus a whole other bunch of complications in an individual. Then we had just one that was sort of a gradual progressive CO2 retainer and got to the point that went into respiratory failure. And then there's the largest group, 26, who had been on some sort of supportive care with their respirators. Like you either slept in a tank or they used a cuirass or they were using a pneumobelt in the day and a cuirass at night, and or they were getting along, but something came up, usually a respiratory infection, an atelectasis, something of this sort. And they couldn't be effectively ventilated with this equipment any longer. Maybe their compliance got a little worse too as time goes by. I haven't duplicated Affelt and Collier's study, and I don't think that was all done in tanks, so I don't know that a lot of people want to come back in the tank for the study, but I think they probably are a little tighter. And then just to look at the late trachs and the ones that did not require respirators, it's obvious that the ones that didn't require respirators had a much better vital capacity by average, and there were only a few that had anything under a liter. The reason for them was a multitude of causes, and so we had these people um, on the tracheostomies, and usually with a PBV respirator at this time. Many of them went on 170Cs initially, and that stopped being made. And so the PBVs are that variety, the Thompson LPs and so on, work quite well for this and are very portable and work well. The average vital capacity, I don't have on this slide, but what I did is I had about 10 or 12 patients that I was able to look at an early vital capacity and follow it up to a later vital capacity after they'd stabilized to calculate what appeared to be the average loss of their vital capacities per year. And it averaged 28 milliliters. And Fletcher's studies in England suggested that 30 milliliters is normal. And other studies have also supported that. So that what I'm saying here is that over the years, and this was something like 158 patient years with this group of these people with trachs that I followed and looked at, they lose a normal rate. What they did is start with a low vital capacity, and it got lower. And there's a certain cutoff when people just can't maintain the required tidal volume, and they fatigue, and when they get to a low enough vital capacity, they eventually require a respirator. Whether they need a trach or not, I think that's just a good indication of today. They come in and they get trachs. 30 years ago, they came in and they went in a tank. We still have a few people that come in and go in a tank because that's all they're put up with. We have one lady who wears a cuirass. She has no abdominals. She hasn't much of anything, really, as far as respiratory muscles are concerned. So she uses a cuirass, and she has her attendant's coffer with a cuirass. And they lean on it, you know, it gives a nice round coughing effect. Trouble is, she breaks the cuirass every month or two, you know, and the life care services are getting a little tired of replacing her cuirass. But she comes in with an atelectasis periodically, and what do we do about it? Well, we suction her out and clap her, and sometimes it comes out pretty well, but she claps the whole lobe. And then she clears up, and during this time, there are various people in there trying to talk her into a trach, but no way. And as long as she can stay out, that's her prerogative. So other things that I'd mention here of this 32 I'd like to discuss now. I have no slides on those. But these folks came for the first time, as I mentioned, and 13 of the 32 were quadriplegics. The others had variable extremity and trunk weakness. So one had bulbar symptoms with shoulder residuals and had symptoms of problems swallowing and aspirating occasionally. 22 of these 32 required respiratory support at onset, and 10 required some support at the time of that I saw them. 18 of the 32 had abdominal paresis, and 10 had some degree of diaphragmatic paresis. 5 had tracheostomies. 8 of these folks used glossopharyngeal breathing. So their vital capacities varied from 100. I don't know if that's accurate, but probably as good as we can get, up to 4250 with a mean of about 1850. So new symptoms. Now these are the folks that came in because they'd heard about things happening to post-polios. I would say that there were 17 that described symptoms, and there's only one pain, and that turned out to be a lecranon bursitis in somebody that didn't play tennis. And most of the problems were kind of general and nonspecific, as many of them we've heard right now. There were 6 patients complained of generalized fatigue, 6 complained of generalized weakness, 4 of them complained of dyspnea. And one of these patients we looked at had sleep apnea. And we, at that time, had an ear oximeter, which demonstrated falls of the oxygen to 83% saturation. And we had in the group of Yeah, let's see. I got two groups, and so we had a total of six people with some sleep apnea syndrome. So we had two in this group. This other one we didn't really document, but had nocturnal anxiety problems. And I think we may have corrected this by readjusting your carass, and which wasn't getting a seal very well. And we also, she was hypoxemic in the recumbent position, so we prescribed oxygen. And we also gave her some protriptyline just to, you know, kick things off. And protriptyline has been found to be useful in both central and obstructive sleep apnea. At the time of this patient's evaluation, we did not have the respiratrace. It was a little difficult sometimes with the staffing to be sure just what kind. But many of them had symptoms that sounded like obstructive sleep apnea. And of the other group, we also had some four patients. So we had about a total of six out of the total group that I looked at that had good reason to think they had some problems with sleep. We had one patient who could notice, she had a cuirass, and she noticed obstructions at night. She'd wake up and have problems this way. She hadn't been further evaluated at this time. Second patient had obesity, as is most of the story you hear with obstructive sleep apnea. Used mouth positive pressure 6 to 8 hours at night. Had spirometric studies, and that suggested she had a flat loop, suggesting she had some upper airway obstruction just on respiratory studies. And she had frequent snoring episodes at night and some apneic periods when not on the mouth positive respirator. So she may have had a mixed. And the third patient was again obese, kyphoscoliosis, and had numerous complaints of dyspnea at night, was referred for studies. We had another one that was kyphoscoliotic. And we tried nasal CPAP, which I don't know if all of you know about. It's where you give continuous positive airway pressure with a nose mask. And she didn't tolerate that. We've had one successful patient that tolerated it, but we haven't tried too many. So we went to the Bennett mouth seal, which she accepted quite well. And she was able to sleep at night. So we don't know how many of these patients may have had bulbar involvement. We didn't have, as I say, the respiratrace at the time, so I can't really say how many of these may have had central sleep apnea. It has been described, as I'm sure a lot of you know, sleep apnea, mostly described as central in some of the studies. I think they found 52%, that's one study, was central, 32 were mixed, and 16 obstructive. Most of our patients, which don't make much of a big series with six, most of them seem to be obstructive. Just to sort of summarize, the management of these folks and what they need in ventilatory support, and exemplified by the lady who keeps breaking her, having her tendons break her shell every night, every 3 days or two. They need to have their participation in all the care decisions. I think a lot of times when you see somebody come in an acute hospital and they've got these problems, they aren't given much choice. I think this is why a lot of post-polio patients tend to come to institutions that are that know them and know how they feel and let them talk. And because usually the patient turns out okay, and they're the ones that make that decision. Of course, it's important because unlike the patient who is just gets an acute illness, and you treat them for that acute illness, and they're over it, and they no longer have an illness. So these patients who get something like this, and they end up with a trach and another respirator or something, it changes their whole lifestyle. Their whole way of life has to change, and it's a very major decision. So most of them resisted quite a bit. Tracheostomy is one of those things that many patients have a very negative attitude for. The idea they got a trachea hole in their neck. They had one, they closed it, they don't want another one. So we try to keep this going. We try to allow them to have that extra time, and maybe they can get by without it for a good deal longer. We all know that a lot of physicians, and when we deal with polio, we know a lot of physicians have negative feelings about dealing with deformity. Maybe that's why they went into internal medicine and stayed out of orthopedics, or whether they, you know. And so often what happens when these patients go to a private physician and with their attendant, because they need help getting up in the elevator and off and one thing and another, and the attendant's sort of standing there, and the doctor looks at the attendant and says, well, how is she? Or how is he? And every time I say this with a group of polios around, they all nod vigorously because they've all experienced this, sort of like they were a deformed child. And I don't know how we get around that. I would hate to think that the polio hospitals, were polio hospitals, are going to be the only ones that will take care of folks with poliomyelitis, but I think education is important. And this new booklet that Jeannie and I guess the March of Dimes or the Polio Foundation may be taking over and printing up, which is a multi-input and explaining what's needed by the polio, what their problems are, and so on. And we have a lot of polios that are just waiting for that. They want to take it to their doctor, and so they can show them, give it to them, read it before you touch me type thing. So I think that kind of education is important, and I hope it will come across. And I think that the post-polios probably are one of the more remarkable groups of survivors that we've got in our society, and most of the folks I know are very fiercely independent and very, very capable, and otherwise perhaps they wouldn't be doing as well as they are. So that's all I want to say right now.
Any questions for Dr. Fisher?
Yes, I have one about the book you mentioned. Is that going to be dealing just with respiratory problems, or is that
No, this is a post-polio handbook. It'll have respiratory stuff in it, but
so it's total
post-polio
management.
Yeah, yeah.
And what's the status of that? You alluded to
just about ready.
It's in the manuscript, and just today, Dr. Salisbury looked at it. Should have Dr. Salisbury too. I'm Jenny Laurie from St. Louis. It's in manuscript form. We've been working on it for over a year. Dr. Fisher has worked on it, and Dr. Maynard. And it's excerpts from the two conferences that the Gazette did in Chicago and in St. Louis, so it includes Dr. Alba and everything. It covers every phase of polio, and it's in alphabetical form, very simple, and the respiratory part is in the back, so there are details there of equipment and respiratory therapists and Dr. Fisher's, but all the way through, every single thing, coughing, now we have hiccups, or about to have altitude, constipation, in this form, just a little brief, and a handbook about this size. And Dr. Salisbury read it today, and he said he's interested in going to consider the March of Dimes distributing it. So you might ask him if he wants to.
Yeah. Dr. Salisbury, would you like to comment on that role you're playing?
No, I think as usual, Jenny said it all. we see this as needed, and this is a very good start on movement, I think. And I think tomorrow morning we'll talk about other publication plans that we might have through our group tomorrow.
Dr. Fisher, I'm Dr. Parsons from Denver. I'm curious about why glossopharyngeal breathing has not found more acceptance among traumatic spinal cord injury. I know that some folks who are probably better at teaching it are getting better responses from their patients, but others who have taught it well to polios have found that the spinal cord folk are not quite so able to do it. I wonder if that has something to do with the lack of sensation in the chest cavity, being unable to feel when one has a full breath.
That's possible. I haven't really looked into that. I think I'll start inquiring about it. Our occupational therapists at Rancho do most of the teaching of glossopharyngeal breathing, and I was when they had a spinal cord respiratory area over in the spinal cord injury service for a while, and I was making rounds and seeing more of these folks. And that just struck me that they didn't seem to very commonly become knowledgeable of it. So,
I'd like to answer that as well. The polio patients came out of body respirators by frog breathing. The spinal cord injury is on a tracheostomy, which they don't mind at all. They like it better than breathing through their mouths. I call it the umbilical cord, so that they really have no incentive to learn frog breathing. This, I think, is the biggest factor. You should have some feeling of a deep breath if you have a vagus nerve, which is still intact in the spinal cord injured. Okay.
Yeah, that's been my impression of the few that I've seen that just didn't seem to have much reason to want to do it. They were all hooked up.
Just one question about recent adoption of frog breathing. I think since the 81 and 83 conferences where Dr. Alva and I think Dr. Johnson's film was shown across the Canadian network, there's been a readoption or an interest in it, not just as a survival strategy, but also as an exercise. And Brian Kirk's respiratory unit, which handles about 26 of the post-polios in Manitoba, is using it as an exercise strategy as well, in addition to a sort of secondary backup. Mm-hmm. I think Edmonton has just produced what's a new film that sort of parallels Dr. Johnson's earlier one. So the diffusion and the survivor network of it since Jenny's first conference, I think, is an interesting side effect.
Yes. It certainly should be helpful if they all will learn it.
While we're over here.
Yeah. I measured the glossopharyngeal breathing to see how much they got in on each gulp, and some of the patients got from about 40 to 100 milliliters. I've gotten more in some of my residents. I used to have a session every year to teach the residents how to do it, and the best way Dr. Montero has taught it, I noticed, spinal cord injured patients. We've taught it to muscular dystrophy, Duchenne, because we know they need it later on. But the way to teach it is to give them some bubble gum, and they blow the bubble gum, and then break the bubble in your mouth. That's exactly the technique that is used in that. The comment I wanted to make was about irrespective of the breathing pattern, when someone lies down, because of the fluid, the blood in the lungs, they lose about 5% of their vital capacity. So some of the people who are having trouble sleeping at night but get along during the day may have that problem. The other thing I wanted to ask you was, with the positive pressure by nose, do they swallow any of it and get a big stomach, or do you have that problem?
I haven't had quite that much experience with it. We've tried it on about three people, one of whom it worked pretty well for. He was an obesity hypoventilator. And no, he didn't seem to get distended. He probably automatically kind of used the positive pressure like many people use a mouse stick while they're asleep. I don't know how they do it, but they let the air out.
Dr. David Rappaport in Bellevue is the one who started this for sleep apnea, for obstructive sleep apnea, and he's not reported people swallowing it. I think if you build up too high a pressure, about 25 centimeters of water, which they don't have to do for sleep apnea, then you break through the cricopharyngeus muscle sphincter, okay, and get it into your stomach.
when you diagnosed the sleep apnea, did you perform the formal sleep study?
No. Actually, most of those patients, it was a clinical historical thing that suggested it. We did have several that we did ear oximetries on and showed a significant drop in their oxygen saturation. We also have been now using a respiratrace to mark the abdominal and chest movements in addition to a capnograph to check their CO2s and the ear oximetry. So we're gradually, as we can get money from one place or another, adding to our nighttime sleep lab, but it's obviously something that's present a lot more than we never used to think about, you know, and it's one of those things that you'll suddenly discover that a high percentage of the population has some kind of problem with it. I don't know if they all need some sort of device to help, but it's a problem.
I was going to add one more comment to why it's probably not being as effective in spinal cord injury, and there's two factors. One is that that the level of patient who needs respiratory assistance also has a lack of musculature over the lower part of their neck, and it's just suboccipital control. And we used to, in the polios, have to strap some of the heads to give them that kind of support. And the other is we find the spinal cord injury, a respiratory-dependent patient, more fragile than the polio. They get too much and too little too easy, and so they may be closer margins.
Yeah, they're very marginal. I don't know what it is.
Thank you very much, Dr. Fisher. Our next speaker is Dr. Jacqueline Perry from Ranches Los Amigos Hospital. I think she's known to all of you, and she'll present orthopedic complications and management, surgery and bracing.
Does this work?
Yeah.
I wonder. Is that all right? Good. We can just put it on. During the last 5 years, we've had 193 patients go through the orthopedic clinic, or my so-called polio clinic. And I'm going to give you some sort of just examples of the experiences we've had in that group, as well as examples of kinds of techniques we're using. We've not had an organized, good photographic recording of all these, and so sometimes my pre and post won't be the same patient, so take them as concepts rather than individuals. And I hope you'll trust my professional integrity enough to say if I say something works, it does, even though I don't have a post-op or a post-orthotic example. Of this 193, the average age has been is about 42 years, and they're averaging about 35 years post-polio, and it's interesting that, including the Taiwanese who are now coming in, that only 7% of the population in this clinic have less than 20 years post-polio experience, and two-thirds are more than 30. So we are seeing a fairly late group. Two-thirds of the patients are complaining of pain and about one-third of muscular weakness. We didn't really break out fatigue in numbers. I'm going to look at the basic problems. The most frequent one is a hyperextended knee, and that's about half of the pain problems. And in order to give you an idea of the significance of this, I'd like to look a little bit at the normal gait. And the green line is a visible representation of the force plate record, and it gives you an idea of where the weight line is. And at the beginning of the stride, it's in front of the knee, and so we have a momentary extensor thrust on the knee, but already the heel strike is beginning to drive the foot down and the tibia forward into flexion, so that we have almost an instantaneous correction of that extended moment. Then go into a flexor moment, and then have a very brief, and then have another period of extension, but notice that the body weight line is very close to knee axis, and so there's not much hyperextension. The protections a normal person has also is hamstring activity during the initial loading response, and then the soleus would be, the gastric knee would be protecting the knee in stance. And actually with those muscles, one can stand even without a quadriceps, even with a knee flexion deformity. In the person with a hyperextended knee who's using this for limb support, what you have is a person who's very severely disabled, because that says they lack the hamstring or hip extensor and calf activity to protect themselves. And you can see they start loading in fairly neutral. And start weight-bearing area very quickly and soon have a very large vector which persists throughout the entire weight-bearing period.
This is the end of side one. Please turn your tape over now to continue listening on side two.